Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Samina Spin. I'm your host, Samina Mughal. Hope everyone is well this fine Wednesday evening. So welcome to episode 18, my favorite books that empower women. If you'd like to chime in and give me your spin on this topic, you can call in at 323-642-1775. Again, that number to call in is 323-642-1775. I'd love to hear from you. One of the foundations of my life is strength. I grew up around strong men and women. I don't know how not to be strong. I had the luxury of drawing upon the examples around me. But it also comes from just wanting to be left alone, to be who I wanted to be and constantly being told what I should be. So I had to be strong to be who I wanted to be because most of the time what I wanted, who I was, didn't fit someone else's narrative. I didn't really have a role model for that. I had to be my own to be that strong woman who asserts herself and who she is. For that reason, I made a decision to be that role model for not just myself, but for other young girls to be who they are, no matter what someone else thinks they should be. Maya Angelou said something along these lines that speaks to me. She said, "I'd love to see a young girl go out and grab the world by the lapels. Life's a bitch. You've got to go out and kick ass." Those are my sentiments exactly, except now I don't feel the need to grab the world by the lapels. I just stand my ground and my truth. That's enough. When I did feel that need, I was inspired by many things. The people around me, some of the people I saw in the news, but I was really inspired by books. My favorite books feature strong female characters as the heroines. Two of those empowered women were Jane Eyre from the book Jane Eyre, which is my all-time favorite book, and Pride and Elizabeth Bennet, who is the heroine in Pride and Prejudice. Those two women in particular always spoke to me because those novels were written during the Victorian age by women, with strong women as the central characters. Now, Jane Eyre, what I loved about Jane Eyre was that she was the heroine, but she wasn't your typical heroine in that time. She wasn't beautiful. She wasn't charming. She didn't attract a lot of attention. But what she was intelligent and respectful of herself and who she was. She actually had self-worth when really all odds were stacked against her to have that self-worth. All she wanted was to love and be loved, but the whole novel is her search for love because she's an orphan. So by all rights, at that time, an orphan, being a woman who's plain with no family connections, who's poor, she shouldn't really have any self-worth. Not at that time, but she did. And she had that inherently. And she doesn't even know where it comes from. She's telling her own story in the book. And some of the time, something's coming out of her, some emotion or whatever, and she doesn't even know where it comes from. But she gets pushed to a certain point, and she goes there. So I'm going to do something a little different today. And I'm actually going to read to you a passage that really speaks to me and speaks to what I'm talking about. So in this particular passage, Jane Eyre has come upon Mr. Rochester, who is her employer and also the man she's in love with, which is another taboo of the time because they have different stations. She's a governess in his house, and she is her boss, basically, and an aristocrat. At that time, that wouldn't have happened. They wouldn't have gotten together, but she was in love with him. And he was intelligent, she was intelligent. It was very much a meeting of the minds. So in the scene that I'm going to read to you, she thinks, because Mr. Rochester has made her think for reasons of his own, she thinks that she has to be sent away because he's going to be getting married, because she can't stay there as the governess if he has a wife. So she's feeling down about that, and she bumps into him in his garden around the estate. And he tells her that he found her another governess job with Mrs. O'Gall of Bitternut Lodge in Ireland. So just the name, Mrs. O'Gall, that she has some sort of gall in Bitternut Lodge. And he does that on purpose. I'll tell you why he does that on purpose. So that's essentially not a real name. It's not a real job, but just to stick it to her a little bit, he names the place Bitternut Lodge, because essentially her leaving is a bitter nut for her to swallow. So he is playing along with her, or just playing with her. Again, I'll tell you why in a minute. And he's told her that I've gotten you a job somewhere else. So this is her response to that. So this is Jane Eyre who's speaking. It's a long way off, sir. No matter. A girl of your sense will not object to the voyage or the distance. This is Mr. Rochester. Not the voyage, but the distance, and then the sea as a barrier. From what, Jane? From England and from Thornfield and, well, from you, sir. I said this almost involuntarily and with as little sanction of free will. My tears gushed out. I did not cry so as to be heard. However, I avoided sobbing. The thought of Mrs. O'Gall and Bitternut Lodge struck cold to my heart, and colder the thought of all the brine and foam destined, as it seemed, to rush between me and the master at whose side I now walked, and coldest the embrace, and coldest the remembrance of the wider ocean, wealth, caste, custom intervened between me and what I naturally and inevitably loved. The vehemence of emotion stirred by grief and love within me was claiming mastery and struggling for full sway and asserting a right to predominate, to overcome, to live, rise, and reign at last. Yes, and to speak. I grieve to leave Thornfield. I love Thornfield. I love it because I have lived in it a full and delightful life, momentarily at least. I have not been trampled on. I have not been petrified. I have not been buried with inferior minds and excluded from every glimpse of communion with what is bright and energetic and high. I have talked face to face with what I reverence, with what I delight in, with an original, a vigorous, and expanded mind. I have known you, Mr. Rochester, and it strikes me with terror and anguish to feel I absolutely must be torn from you forever. I see the necessity of departure, and it is like looking on the necessity of death. Where do you see the necessity? He asks suddenly. And then they go back and forth, and she basically reminds him, you are getting married, so I have to leave. And then he all of a sudden says, no, you can't leave. You can't leave. And that to which she responds, I tell you I must go, I retorted, roused to something like passion. Do you think I can stay to become nothing to you? Do you think I am an automation, a machine without feelings, and can bear to have my morsel of bread snatched from my lips and my drop of living water dashed from my cup? Do you think because I am poor, obscure, plain, and little, I am soulless and heartless? You think wrong. I have as much soul as you, and full as much heart. And if God had gifted me with some beauty and much wealth, I should have made it as hard for you to leave me as it is now for me to leave you. I am not talking to you now through the medium of custom, conventionalities, nor even of mortal flesh. It is my spirit that addresses your spirit, just as they both had passed through the grave and we stood at God's feet, equal as we are. So in this scene, she says it all. She's She's defying custom, convention, and even her own flesh. It's her spirit coming out and telling him that I love you and I just don't want to be parted from you. And she says it. And she has no idea that he loves her in return. And this whole thing, him pretending that he loves someone else and that he's going to marry someone else, was just to draw her out and make her jealous so she would admit all that. But in this scene, that's her in a time where she has no right to assert herself like that to someone who's technically her superior. She asserts herself and just says, look, I love you, and you know, it doesn't matter that I'm poor or that I'm plain. I have as much right to be happy as anyone else, and I'm telling you how I feel. So that's just one of the places where she does that. The first time she does it, she's maybe 10 years old, and she's basically telling off the woman that raised her for the first 10 years of her life, who was nasty and cold to her. She's basically telling her off and just saying, I deserve to be treated better. And even in that situation, she knows that she deserves to be treated better. And then she asserts herself again when she's, I won't ruin the book for you, but when she's somewhat betrayed by Rochester, and she says, look, I won't be treated this way, and I won't stand for this. I know that I'm on my own and nobody really cares and no one would really frown upon what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, but I care about myself and I know who I am. She does things like that throughout the book. She says things like that throughout the book. But the main theme, the whole novel, is that she wants to be loved, and she knows that she deserves to be loved, even though society and convention tells her she doesn't really deserve what she wants. She says, no, I deserve what I want. So that's one of the many reasons it's one of my favorite books. And it's on my list of books that empower women. It's one of the best books that empower women because the main character is empowered throughout the novel, from beginning to end. Another novel that is empowering to women and is another one of my favorites is Pride and Prejudice. You have a lot of female characters, different strong female characters in the book, but the main character, Elizabeth Bennet, is probably the most intriguing because she's the smartest. But at the same time, she does fit the convention of the Victorian heroine. She's beautiful. She's not really wealthy, but she is an aristocrat. Her father is a gentleman. Poor aristocrat, but she's still an aristocrat. She's still a member of society. But she's highly intelligent and beautiful. Now, she draws people in with her beauty, but many times she can turn people away with her mouth because she'll tell it like it is and she'll do it unapologetically. Excuse me. So the passage that I'm going to read from this is one of my favorites because Mr. Darcy, who's been a snob to her for most of the book, is coming to her and admitting that he's in love with her, and he actually proposes marriage, but he does it in the most snobby and offensive way that he actually turns her off. She already dislikes him at this point in the book. She already dislikes him, and his manner of proposing to her is essentially, you know, it's beneath me to love you, so I do, so will you marry me? That's essentially what he says. So she already doesn't like him. And then couple that with the fact that he gives her a half-assed marriage proposal, she loses it on him. And she doesn't care. So start off with a little bit of background, and then I'll go into what she says. Elizabeth felt herself growing more angry every moment, yet she tried to the utmost to speak with composure when she said, "You are mistaken, Mr. Darcy, if you suppose that the mode of your declaration affected me in any other way than as it spared me the concern which I might have felt in refusing you, had you behaved in a more gentlemanlike manner." She saw him start at this, but he said nothing, and she continued. "You could not have made me the offer of your hand in any possible way that would have tempted me to accept it." Again, his astonishment was obvious, and he looked at her with an expression of mingled incredulity and mortification. She went on. "From the very beginning, from the first moment, I may almost say, of my acquaintance with you, your manners, impressing me with the fullest belief of your arrogance, your conceit, and your selfish disdain of the feelings of others, were such as to form that groundwork probation on which succeeding events have built so immovable a dislike. And had I not known you a month before, I felt that you were the last man in the world whom I could ever be prevailed on to marry." "And I had not known you a month before I felt that you were the last man in the world whom I could ever be prevailed on to marry." So not only does she say no, she says, "Hell no. No, I don't want to marry you." Now, again, this is the Victorian age. This is the 19th century. At that time, women were clamoring to get married. Now, this particular character, Mr. Darcy is one of the wealthiest men in the town. Every woman is trying to land him, is trying to clamor to marry him. And he wants to marry Elizabeth. But instead of falling in line with that way of thinking, "Oh, my life is made. Here's this good-looking, wealthy man with connections. He wants to marry me." She says, "No, I don't like you. I don't like you because you're rude, you're obnoxious, you don't care about other people's feelings." And not only does she just say, "No, I don't want to," she says no in the strongest manner possible. And she's justified in saying it in that way because he basically insults her at the same time that he's proposing to her. So she went in on him. And for her to do that at this time, for Jane Austen to write a woman who would do that, unapologetic about it, she doesn't care. Like, of course, Mr. Darcy is upset and mortified and can't believe it. She doesn't care. And then, you know, as this whole thing percolates, she gets even more irritated by the whole situation. So she does this, and it's not just a heat-of-the-moment thing. She's well aware of what she's doing, and she's okay with it. She owns it. And again, for her to do that at this time, even now, there are many women who would just marry an asshole just to have a shot at his money or because of who he is or whatever. So for a woman to do this, especially at this time, and then in her situation as well, her family situation, her father's broke. Her father has nothing to leave her. So she could have considered that and said, yeah, but she said, "No, I don't want to marry somebody I don't like." So there you go. So that's a big reason that's one of my favorites, like her passion and her persistence in speaking her truth throughout the novel. And that's the thing both Jane Eyre, Pride and Prejudice, have in common. Throughout the novel, both these women, even though they do change from the beginning to the end, both of these women really own who they are and are proud of who they are. And they're not apologizing for anything. They show you who they are, straight, no chaser. Now, reading books like that has affected me in my life because I'm pretty much straight, no chaser. So I've always gravitated to those kinds of books, and they've always buoyed me up in being that straight, no chaser kind of person. Those kinds of novels have also affected how I write. In my first book, Scheherazade's Daughters, I wanted to write something that was like Arabian Nights, but I thought to myself, there aren't that many strong female characters in Arabian Nights. There's a narrator, Scheherazade, and then there's Morgiana, and then there's it just was on the tip of my tongue. But there's these other women. I can't remember their names now. There are these other women who are evil and calculating. They're strong women, but they're not very positive. So there are maybe two positive, strong women throughout that canon that you can remember by name. So when I set out to write Scheherazade's Daughters, I just thought, well, let me make these stories center around clever, independent women. So each story has a bunch of those. There are about 18 major female characters in that book because it's a collection of short stories, but the thing they all have in common is that they're strong, independent women who want to live their lives the way they want to live their lives without someone pointing fingers at them and telling them what they should do or how they should be. Because men don't get that, so why should women? So I wrote my characters like that. They're all very different. They all have their own ways and their trials and their tribulations. But I wanted women who were steadfast in who they were, even to the point where sometimes the decisions they make are actually wrong. So they're not perfect. They're strong and intelligent. Jane Eyre was not perfect. Jane Eyre was actually very naive, and Elizabeth Bennet was not perfect because she's the prejudice in Pride and Prejudice, because what she doesn't realize about Mr. Darcy is that he's actually a really good guy. Of course, he doesn't help her along, but she believes stories about him without finding out for herself, so she has that prejudice towards him in the beginning. So she's not a perfect character. So the characters I wrote, while being strong and intelligent and beautiful, they're not perfect characters. They're flawed. And sometimes their own strength gets in their way because they don't want to back down even when they should. They don't want to show that vulnerability. So my characters are inspired by characters like Jane Eyre and Elizabeth Bennet. And they're also inspired by me and who I want to be in my life. So one of the stories that I have, and I'll share it with you very briefly. Now, I named a character after Morgiana from Arabian Nights. She's not the same as she was in Ali Baba. She's just named after her. So she's an astute and intelligent businesswoman. So here's a description of who she is, what she's about. So she has a father named Omar. And I'm going to start from where Omar notices his daughter's gifts. Omar noticed his daughter's intelligence early in her life. Whatever he taught her, she learned quickly. Many times she was one step ahead of him. As she grew older, he noticed the eloquence of her speech and her sharp tongue and wit. However, she was beautiful and could charm anyone, particularly when she was conducting business. Yet, even if she were not beautiful, she still had a natural acumen in business. In fact, she was so good that Omar wondered why Allah did not just make her a boy. Just would have made their lives easier. Still, he accepted it and nurtured her as best he could because her talents demanded it. He would not shortchange her simply because he thought Allah made an odd choice with her gender. Later on, he would see that Morgiana would not be held back because she was a woman. She had an ease with people, but suffered no fools. So it would have shocked her father had he lived to see it when the biggest fool entered her life and altered her world forever. So I deliberately wrote a character who was as capable as any man, but had her feminine side. I think that's empowering as well, to make a woman strong and competent, but feminine as well. Both can exist. Both should exist. That's what I try to do when I write. I try to read writers who do that. I try to be a writer who does that. I try to be that author who empowers women. And one day, I hope to be someone's favorite book that empowers women. But until then, I leave you with this. Above all, be the heroine of your life, not the victim. Nora Ephron. If you like what you have heard in this podcast and would like to hear more, I have two books available on Amazon, Scheherazade's Daughters and the Siddiqui Brothers in Cairo. If you would like to read my Behind and Beyond the Veil blog, you can check it out on www.saminakmogul.com. Actually, this week, I've written something similar to what I just talked about. I wrote my list of six books that are universally feminist, and I talk about some books that I didn't talk about in this podcast. Go check it out if you're curious to see what other books I consider feminist. I thank you for listening. Until next time, that's the Samina Spin. Good night and love and light.